up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and you have downloaded, and hopefully you'll subscribe and rate, my All Ball podcast. All basketball, all the time. On today's podcast. Now, keep in mind, this one is in the can as of Wednesday, July 3rd. So you listen to this on the 4th of July or slightly beyond. There's not all of this is going to be dated. One part that will be is Dan Wojcicki. We'll get his thoughts on the Lakers and on the Clippers and on what they're doing and how Kawhi Leonard and his decision affects the Lakers and the Clippers in L.A. basketball. Dan writes for the L.A. Times. We'll also be joined by Pat Garrity. Pat is the assistant general manager of the Detroit Pistons. He's formerly the president of the NBAPA. He also has a master's degree from Duke University School of Business, as well as an undergrad from the University of Notre Dame. He and I played together for a year, and he's an unbelievably bright guy with an amazing kind of personal story. Wait till you hear how he became an assistant general manager in the NBA, and we'll also talk about the Blake Griffin trade and how it actually happened, whose idea it really, really was. But let me give you a couple of different things, a couple of different thoughts before we get to Dan Wojcicki. So, look, I think I'm in line with just about everybody on the Utah thing. I like the Jazz a lot. And while Houston stayed pat and doesn't seem to be happy about it, Golden State's going to have to rebuild, and we'll try and figure out what they're going to throw out there. We're waiting to see if Kawhi joins either the LA teams. Either one he joins becomes a contender, and if he joins the Lakers, they become a favorite. The Spurs are still out there. The Mavericks should be better. I think the Thunder should be better. And, of course, they haven't been able to move Steven Adams or Dennis Schroeder to this point, but it's a long offseason. So I like the Jazz. You know, some things have to go. Mike Conley has to stay healthy, and it's a long season. He makes a lot of money. He's their point guard. They put a lot of shooting around around their best player. So I get it. I think it could work. I think it could work. But if the Lakers aren't competitive at the end of the year, I'd be surprised. And if the Lakers aren't favorites at the end of the year, I'd be surprised. If the Lakers had Kawhi Leonard, I do think they're an overwhelming favorite. I'll only point this out that there's some extenuating circumstances as to why it's okay for Kawhi to go to L.A. He told San Antonio that's where he wanted to go. It is, in fact, the Lakers. It is, in fact, home. And it's not like his choice is, well, you could be 5 hours from home or right here at home. No, his choice is a different country. Is a different country. But let's get into what is the best decision. I mean, brand-wise, I think probably the Lakers. Basketball-wise, probably the Clippers. But if you like the idea of, hey, I can always come back to L.A. and always be somebody in L.A. and I own a whole country, like, the Toronto thing's not a bad play. The Clipper thing seems to be more how he wants to play basketball. It just does. The problem is you're betting on the Clippers and their culture carrying over into another year. And, you know, they will have Lou Williams, they have Montrezl Harrell, they'll have Patrick Beverley, and now they would have a star to kind of go to. Like, I like all of those things. But you're going to try and do something that has literally never been done. Like, Toronto hadn't been done, but they had some form of playoff success. The Clippers have had none. I think he fits best for the Clippers. And I think the fascinating point is that the Clippers have spent a year trying to do everything the right way in order to get him. And now we have no idea if that actually works. Like, why'd they hire Lee Jenkins? Why'd they fire Bruce Bowen? All just to get this one guy. So I feel for the Clippers if it doesn't go through, but it's not their fault. But they would, in fact, still be the Clippers if they didn't get him. The Lakers, look, I think they're going to be fine. They got Anthony Davis. They got LeBron James. I don't think their expectations were to get Kawhi Leonard. I think they thought, you know, we should have a shot at this thing. I think it's become a little bit, they've got a couple more dates than they thought they would get. Like, they thought, all right, we'll get to have a drink with her. But now they've got to have a drink. They've got to have dinner. They've got to have dessert. walk down the beach. Now they're going in, right? And then you have Toronto, who they haven't done anything wrong. They moved mountains with no promises and got what they wanted and threw out the absolute red carpet, and they want to contain their excitement. And while everybody's being told to be quiet, the Raptors fans somehow figured out where the meeting is, and they surround the place. They just want him to know they love him, which I'm sure he knows. And I can't blame Raptors fans. I will tell you, though, it's a weird time in Los Angeles where Magic Johnson is so attention-starved that he's clearly leaked out stories that, hey, don't worry, I'm handling the Kawhi thing, so that if they get Kawhi, Magic gets some form of credit, and if they don't, the blame is cast at the foot of Rob Pelinka, not of Magic Johnson. However accurate that might be, that may be super accurate, I don't know. It's not something you do. Unless, of course, you're Magic and you're trying to save your brand when other people have taken shots at it. But most of the reason they've taken shots at it is not on the court. It's the fact that we all know you haven't showed up ready to work every day for what your job entails. All right, here's what we're going to do. Dan Wojcicki is going to join us from the LA Times. Get his thoughts on all things Kawhi Leonard. If, when, why, how, whatever. And then we'll talk to Pat Garrity of the Detroit Pistons. Here's my discussion with Dan Wojcicki of the LA Times. Okay, so Dan, let's start with the Lakers, because this is weird, right? Like, the whole thing is just, I mean, I know some people in the organization. I know you know probably even more people in the organization, people that have left the organization. Obviously, there's that kind of small group that's always been there. But you go from, all right, Magic has a plan, he and Pelinka somehow kind of coexisting, to Magic calling Pelinka a backstabber, quitting early, going on TV, kind of napalming the place. They still pull off the Anthony Davis trade. And now all of a sudden they're a finalist for Kawhi, whereas everyone else thought no shot that Kawhi wanted to be there. How would you characterize what this Laker thing has been like?
I mean, I think, Doug, this has been like a really big victory for the Lakers as a brand, right? It's a reminder, I think, of how strong the purple and gold and the history and sort of the great superstars have meant, and how important they still are to people around the NBA. Because if we're being honest, the Lakers didn't do anything other than merely having the cap space. They didn't do anything strategically right. They didn't put together a wildly interesting young core to get LeBron James. They did it just kind of by being in Los Angeles, right? Like, this is how they got him. And because of their history and because of what it means to be a Laker, the same kind of goes for getting Anthony Davis. Rob Pelinka, you know, certainly signed off on the trade, but, you know, pretty much just opened up the wallet and said, take whatever players you want, take whatever draft picks you want. We have to get this done. And they got that done. To be in this Kawhi position that they're in is a surprise to a lot of people who know Kawhi, a lot of people who've been around Kawhi. It's not as big of a surprise, believe it or not, to some of the other teams chasing him, who always kind of feared the Lakers a little bit. I think, again, because of sort of respect of what they are in terms of a marquee place and what they mean to people. It's not a typical what I'm looking for. It's just not a typical franchise in that sense, right? Like, it's what the Knicks want to be. The Lakers are actually the actualized version of it, and I think we've seen that in these last two off seasons.
Makes sense. No, it's a great point. And the interesting thing is the Knicks, for the most part, have their young players. They didn't hold on to Porzingis, but they have their young players, whereas outside of Kyle Kuzma, the Lakers do not, although Kuzma does fit with what they want to do. Just kind of outside the box thought here. Is there any chance that he's doing this and making the Lakers believe they have a shot so that he can ultimately choose the Clippers and it hurts the Lakers because there's no one left to fill that salary spot?
I mean, I think it's certainly a little bit of a possibility, but it doesn't seem to line up kind of with, you know, the kind of person that you know, we think Kawhi Leonard is. Everything, too, about what we know or about Kawhi Leonard, it should be kind of come with the asterisk of like, well, this is what we've either been able to decipher or have heard, because we don't know a lot about him personally. Very few people do. He's, you know, everybody kind of knows this. He's a pretty guarded person. You know, it doesn't make a ton of sense. I was looking around today, Doug. I was thinking about it. You know, the decision, when LeBron did the decision, it came on July 8th, right? Like, so over a week into free agency. I think what happened here this year is you've got a player who actually wanted to take meetings, who wanted to take his time because he knows he's making an important decision, and you had a free agent market that didn't wait for him, which is a little bizarre, right? Like, typically the market kind of waits for a guy like Kawhi Leonard. Well, that didn't happen this year. It was sort of, you know, as if someone had kind of grabbed a hose and kinked it and got it nice and tight so nothing was coming out. And then at 3 o'clock on Sunday, you open it and just all of a sudden all the free agents are gone, you know, and billions of dollars have been committed and all of this stuff within 20 minutes. And, you know, yeah, like the market's pretty picked over. I think this to me is much more about, you know, a career altering decision than it is about, you know, screwing over the Lakers, who, by the way, whether he comes or not, at this point have some really, really interesting decisions to make with the money they'll either have because they don't get Kawhi or with the money they won't have because they do. Filling out a roster with, you know, 8, 9, 10 minimum players is unprecedented in the NBA. And I'm very curious to see about how Rob Pelinka is going to do this, because to me, this is like sort of the test for him. The easy stuff was getting LeBron to commit. The easy stuff was, you know, like I said, just kind of opening up and handing all your money and all your assets over to New Orleans and saying, okay, we want Anthony Davis. That stuff was easy. Like, now this is the hard part, is, you know, getting Kawhi Leonard. Even getting Kawhi Leonard, you know, not really about Rob Pelinka. Filling out the rest of the roster, that's going to be about Rob Pelinka. And I think any sort of praise for him or anything like that has to be reserved until we see what the product looks like.
Yeah. I love Jared Dudley, but I
mean, yeah, Jared Dudley, great signing. Good signing.
Can he actually play basketball anymore?
I mean, you're going to need, see, I think like a little, like he was a little useful, right? In the playoff series with Philadelphia.
The only thing he's really known for is rattling the cage of Ben Simmons and then shooting up a ridiculous air ball. Like,
he played some small ball center in that series, which I think is like, okay, I'm a believer. Obviously, Doug, I think you are too, in positional versatility. Like, that matters. Look, I mean, he was good enough to start 25 games last year. Like, great. But like, this is kind of what the market, I mean, I like Dudley in the sense that I think, and being around the Lakers last year, and seeing kind of the amount of role players you do, because let me unwind this for a second. I think generally speaking, right, there are two different kinds of players you can get on minimum contracts. You get guys who can't get, contracts elsewhere, right? And are there because they want another year in the NBA and they want to keep playing and they want to have a role on the team. And then you have guys who are there because they signed the 1 year minimum or they signed the 1 year deal because they want to go get paid again next summer. Jared Dudley's not a go get paid again next summer guy. So you don't have to worry a lot about, you know, him being selfish. You don't have to worry about a lot of that stuff. And I think again, in this situation, when you're going to have so many guys in that position, having like a good locker room guy, like that's part of it. Now, whether that helps out on the court, you know, hard to say, probably not a ton, but I think, you know, that locker room last year was a very young locker room. It was a separated locker room in a lot of ways. I think having kind of a cohesion guy, like a good teammate guy, I think helps them. What that does on the court, it's impossible to know.
All right, let's talk about the Clippers.
All right.
I don't know. The Nets are like the seventh most popular franchise in New York, right? The baseball teams,
yes.
The football teams. The Knicks are a bigger name, and of course the Rangers are bigger. But Brooklyn has been on the rise as a borough. The arena is spectacular. The location that area is blowing up, and I mean, this is it's not the death knell to the Knicks, but it sure feels like they're in critical care. The Lakers would still have Anthony Davis, would still have LeBron James. But yep. What would it signify if they got Kawhi Leonard?
I mean, I think it would validate sort of the last, like the last 2 years of you know, this organizational path, like since the Blake Griffin trade, really. I mean, it validates all of those moves. And to be honest, let me reset. I don't think they need Kawhi to validate that stuff. I think if you talk to basketball people around the league, and you look at what the Clippers have done, and you look at the decisions they've made, they're operating right now as one of the smarter franchises in the league. And that's not always been the case with the Clippers. Right. You know what I mean? A place where dysfunction has, you know, like it, that should be the first number they retire. It's just a jersey that says dysfunction. You know, that's been more defining of a characteristic than being smart and doing the right thing. And they've been smart and done the right thing. I mean, even in the midst of this Kawhi chase, you know, kind of wedging themselves into a four-team sign and trade so they can get a useful player, Mo Harkless, on an expiring deal, along with another first-round pick. Just being ready for that type of stuff. Like, they've done a very good job. If they get him, I think it is a little bit of a shot across the Lakers' bow. I think they know that they're not going to catch the Lakers, you know, without – getting past the Lakers here is like a 30-year plan. It can't be any quicker than that. I find these things to be generally hard. But it's a big enough market to support two teams. You know, Clipper fans really fell in love with this team last year. I think they would obviously be even more excited about a Kawhi Leonard team. And it would give them a real, real chance at a championship. You know, they've had probably two of those, I think, kind of, if we're being honest, in the Lob City era, like two real good cracks at it. And weird stuff happened both times. This would probably give them their best chance with a really good young roster, tons of flexibility. You know, are they going to overtake the Lakers? I don't think so, not with LeBron and Anthony Davis. But I think they're certainly a viable alternative in the marketplace. And you know, it'd be, again, a very exciting brand of basketball, a really likable kind of hard-nosed, tough-nosed team that the Clipper fans really fell in love with last year.
Last thing, what if he doesn't come back? Like, this would be the second consecutive all-pro level player, all-star level player, and obviously Kawhi is an even higher level player than Paul George, but the second guy who forced his way out of his first home and said, I want to come to L.A., and then is like, nah, I'm good. What if he decides to not come to L.A.? What does it say about Los Angeles professional basketball?
I think to me it says more about like the power. I think it'll be really, and really, I think it'll be good for the league. And here's why. I think when guys are in this situation where they want to be moved late in contracts and stuff like that, you know, this is what worked for Rich Paul with Anthony Davis, right? Is like you suppress the market where only big market teams are in it because you know you're going to lose a guy. You just know it. And so there's no point in going for it. And that consolidates talent in a handful of places. To me, like, if Kawhi goes back, it's just another sort of like another victory for like team go for it and take the risks, right? Like the way Oklahoma City did, the way where they leveraged really good assets for what might only be a year, the way that Toronto did by, you know, trading one of the most popular players, you know, in the country's basketball history, honestly, right? Like, I mean, DeMar DeRozan, so few players have seemed to want to be a part of the Toronto Raptors. DeMar DeRozan did, and they took a huge risk by moving him. You know, they pissed off Kyle Lowry. There were fans that were very upset for a guy that supposedly didn't want to be there. Well, like, you can create a culture and you can recruit that way. And then conversely, I think it's a hit for, like, the big market teams who think they can just sit and wait, you know, and you don't have to make the move. You don't have to give up assets to get guys. No, like, when you have the opportunity, you go and do it. And credit to the Lakers for doing that with Anthony Davis, for not being arrogant, for not just sitting and waiting and letting another team, like maybe say like Denver, come in and make an offer and convince AD to stay in Denver next year. I think that's sort of the exciting part about it for the league, is that it opens up more sort of viable pathways for teams when it comes to acquiring a superstar. And I think as far as like coming home, it's just not for everybody. You know, Kawhi, it does feel like it's important to him, Doug. But, you know, for Paul George, maybe it wasn't that. I mean, he seems like someone who enjoys, like, he has a fishing pond at his house in Oklahoma City. He seems like he likes that.
Yeah. And you know, home doesn't always mean the same thing at the same time in life. It's a fact. As a guy who's lived outside of Southern California a good portion of my professional life, I can tell you that. And I've twice moved back here. It's different both times. And there are things that I love, but there are things that I don't love about it. Obviously, I'm not in their tax bracket, so it's you can love a whole lot more when you're making 30 mil a year. Dan, I appreciate you joining us. I'm, like everybody else, can't wait to see what happens. It's a fascinating time in the NBA, especially here in Los Angeles. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Doug. One thing real quick. I think this is like the one of the best free agencies that I can remember, because it does feel like everybody involved has like made such compelling pitches, and it's pretty open like who the three finalists are. So rarely do we get to find out a ton about a guy as secretive as Kawhi. And I think, you know, whenever he makes a decision, we'll be able to say, oh, well, we know this about him. And that to me is like, I think what I'm most excited about.
I'm with you, right? Like the Clippers thing does feel like, you know, you're that's the little engine that could, and it's about the culture and they build everything around him. Mm-hmm. The Raptors thing would be like, hey, you know what?
Trust.
I didn't think I'd love it, but I did. And I'd rather be king of one country than one of the stars in my hometown. And the Lakers thing, you know, is completely different. Like, I don't even know how it would all work, because some of them, you know, they all kind of need the basketball at some point, but it would be just an impressive embarrassment of riches. And I don't think anyone would argue with the Lakers being back if they got it done, but you're right. They're three very different and very compelling decisions.
Yep.
Dan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Doug.
All right, let's turn you to our long-form discussion of the week. Pat Garrity, when I first met him, I was on my recruiting visit at Notre Dame, and everyone said, like, this is going to be a dude. 6'10", tremendous shooter, Monument, Colorado, brilliant guy. My first semester at Notre Dame, he got 1B. Fran McCaffrey recruited us both, called him in, and said, Pat, we didn't bring you in here to get Bs. And I don't believe he got another one while he's at Notre Dame as a biochem engineer. Now, Fran McCaffrey was actually joking, trying to bust his balls and motivate him. But nonetheless, he did, in fact, want to motivate him, and it did, in fact, work. You go from there to being a first-round draft pick in the NBA, to playing in the league for a decade, to being head of the NBAPA, to getting his MBA, to working in finance with Bridgewater, and then ultimately returning to the NBA as an assistant GM with the Detroit Pistons. What an amazing career he has had. Here's my discussion with Pat Garrity of the Detroit Pistons. Let's start not at the very beginning, because although your childhood is probably really interesting to you, I'm not sure how interesting it is to everybody else. I'm kidding. So, like, look, you grew up. Did you grow up in Monument, Colorado the entire time, or was it other places before you got there?
No, my dad was in the Air Force, so we were all over the place. We were in New York, California, Panama, Texas. So, but from high school on, with the exception of 1 year when I was in South Carolina, it was Monument, Colorado, just outside of Colorado Springs.
Wait, so you moved there in high school?
Yeah, well, I was there through junior high, and then starting from fifth grade, and then we moved away 1 year. Lived in Sumter, South Carolina.
That sounds hot. That sounds really hot.
Yeah. Well, trivia question here: it's the adjacent town to Delzell, which is where John Morant is from. So, right small town in South Carolina. But then Colorado throughout high school.
Okay, so, were you always good? When did you first figure out, this is something I'm going to do?
I felt my career was a little bit like Forrest Gump, because it was like, I always liked playing basketball, and I didn't play any really AAU up until the time I was a junior, and it was just a matter of, you know, show up, was pretty good, got put on the varsity, was pretty good on that, like the next step. And so there was never like any kind of grand plan. There was never any point where it's like, okay, let's really focus on getting with a skills trainer or, you know, strength coach or all the things that kids do now when they show a little bit of talent. I just played a lot. And it wasn't really until my junior year of high school that I started getting interest and offers from, you know, mid-level D1 type schools. And at that point, I just wanted to go to college for free and play basketball. I wasn't thinking professional basketball at all. I thought it was going to be, if I could go to college and crack a rotation and play, that'd be awesome.
But you were always a straight A student. Like, was your dad being military, was he like hardcore? Like, how did How did you have that sort of, that level of discipline personally?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't my. So they were both. My parents were both educated. Both had, you know, beyond bachelor's degrees. My dad has a doctorate in education. My mom has a master's in education. She was a teacher. So, you know, school was always important, but it was never a thing where they were bringing the hammer down. They were pushing, okay, you got to do this so you can get into the best schools. It was just, you know, you were expected to do your best. And it was always something that I took pride in. I mean, I've always been interested in learning and reading, and I had a curious mind. So for me, it was just a matter of that combined with, you know, wanting to be the best at it.
When did Notre Dame first start recruiting you?
Well, so they first started recruiting me in the spring of my junior year. And I remember how it went back. It's funny that this is the way kind of it worked back then, which was, you know, in 1993. But I think I got a letter from Fran McCaffrey, a call, who was one of the assistants at the time. And he said, "Hey, I saw you play. Can you put together some tapes that you can send to us so I can show Coach McCloud?" So I can remember I like rigged two VCRs together and somehow came up with like my highlight tape.
Wait, you had to make your own highlight tape to kind of sell yourself to McCloud?
Yeah, well, because he hadn't seen me yet. It was just Fran who'd seen me somewhere. And I don't know why they didn't just say, "Hey, send us the tapes and we'll make them." But for some reason, it seemed like it made sense that I was like rigging two VCRs together and figuring out how to make tapes. So made my own tape and sent it there. And that kind of started it, where then entering that summer before my senior year, went to ABCD and then played on a team, a Colorado team. It was a pretty good team. Chauncey was on that team, a couple other D1 guys. And then that's when Coach saw me and, you know, started recruiting me a little bit harder.
Do you remember who was on your team at ABCD?
Yeah, I do. Circus King, you remember that?
Yeah,
name, right?
Circus. Yeah, Oakland, California. Sure,
Oakland, California. Really tough, fast point guard. I think he went to Cal.
Could not shoot at all. He was like this is like a childhood rival of mine, because I was supposed to be in your class. I stayed back in eighth grade, so I probably played against Circus King every year, once or twice a year, and I think that was back in the old days of the old Oakland Soldiers, when they actually had players from Oakland. So Circus King, go ahead.
So Circus King was on there. Oma Givens, who ended up going to UCLA, I believe, right?
Yeah, Seattle, from Seattle,
And then the Colorado, all the Colorado guys that were on there. So Chauncey, Ted Kritza, who ended up playing at Colorado, then transferred to Tulane. Who else was on? Those are the names that kind of stick out. But then the big names in the camp, and he was a year younger, but that was the year of like Stephon Marbury, Felipe Lopez, Brendan Hamilton. Those were the big names in that camp. Steve Wojciechowski was like put on some team of
Russian.
I remember he was like on an all Russian team, and I was watching the game, and I'm like, "Who's this guy? This guy's like really good."
I can tell this story on the pod. So the story I remember. So he was on this team of Europeans. And it was him, and there was a cat. I got to get him on this pod. There's him and some cat from like Indiana was on it, maybe one other dude. And they were super fun to watch, right? Everybody else was doing, you know, like high ball screen, ISO, you know, one-on-one bullshit. And like they're moving the ball. And I mean, he looks amazing on this team where they're playing real basketball. But I remember at some point, like we were sitting behind their bench and they had like a translator, or maybe even two translators and the coach, and a guy, like the kid, I'm trying to think who it was, from like Indiana. And they're arguing on the bench, and the kid from Indiana is like, "Yo, tell him to pass me the fucking ball." And like the translator said, and like the Russian kid was like, "You suck my dick," right? Like it was like, wait, all of a sudden he started speaking English because he knew how to curse. It was an amazing thing. That was Ypsilanti, Michigan. So what I remember about that camp, and my dad was our coach, we played in the finals against Team Michigan and lost. But I remember about that camp was, it was sick. It was really hot. It was in their old, you know, their arena was like one of those, whatever they're called, like little half dome type. Like it was kind of ghetto compared to no one would play in one of those buildings now. And they had fans everywhere. And by fans, I mean the actual like metal fans that try and cool you off. And like here we were, a bunch of kids from Southern California. We had a squad. And J.R. Henderson, who was my AAU teammate, was my roommate. And he would come back to the room and wet down towels and lay in bed with a wet towel on each leg and on his forehead to cool off. Like, I remember it was that kind of hot. And like all of us were like, whatever we do, we're not going somewhere where it's humid. Because F this. That's what I remember about that camp.
I think that was the last year I was in. So that was like a bridge year. I think Converse was the company that was underwriting it. And I think then after that, it went to Teaneck, New Jersey, and was there for a long time. As part of, it was the Adidas camp.
Yes, the year before that, it was at UC Irvine. Yeah. And it was, you know, right. But it was also Converse. And that was Ypsilanti, Michigan. And then it was at Fairleigh Dickinson after that.
No, got it. Okay. Yeah, no, it was, I mean, it was the first, there were some unbelievable players. It was the first time I'd seen Antoine Walker play. Like, Walker was well, at that point, I'm like, this is one of the best players I've ever seen. A lot of good players.
That's what was different about it. So Antoine Walker would hang out around our area because we had Jelani Gardner, who was like the best, and Ricky Price. And they would shoot dice and talk trash. And we had, it was pretty, that was the one thing that was different then. Was we used to always go to the Vegas tournaments. We didn't play in the AU national tournaments because the Vegas tournaments was like as far as we would go because everybody would come to us. But you didn't always see people play. So like I remember the year before I was going to be a sophomore and I just went to the ABCD camp and I saw Antonio McDice, right? That was like the first time. But it was one of those times when you may have heard of somebody or maybe you didn't, but all of a sudden you got to see other players from around the country. And it was pretty alarming how good some of these dudes were. Whereas now I do feel like they all kind of see each other and play against each other more.
No, for sure. Now, I mean, with how organized the circuits are now and with how high level, like the UIBL circuit is, like they all know each other. Everyone's seen each other's film, you know, so it's, you're right. I mean, you went to, you know, a tournament in Vegas or like some of the Pump Brothers stuff in Southern California, which was a big thing that the, you know, Colorado teams would go to. You maybe see, you know, one or two high level D1 guys on each team, but it was much more spread out. You'd never see any East Coast players.
Okay. So you show up at Notre Dame. Why did you pick Notre Dame?
Well, so the two schools I was choosing between were Stanford and Notre Dame. And after my visit to Stanford, I was like, I wanted to cancel my visit to Notre Dame. I told my dad, like, look, this place is awesome. It's like beautiful weather. And it wasn't like my dad or my family were big Notre Dame fans, but, you know, he said, just finish it out. You told him you were going to go there, take a visit. And I just remember going there, and it was like the opposite of the Stanford visit. Like the Stanford visit, like teammates were great, you know, went to parties, like weather was terrific. We go to South Bend, it was like it was like parents' weekend, no one was doing anything. I think Ryan Hoover at the time, I still kid him about this, like gave me the $40 that he had to like go take me to dinner, and he's like, hey, you know, you go hang out with this, I gotta go to dinner with my parents. And it was like, from an entertainment standpoint, it was the worst. But I just remember feeling when I talked to, you know, some of the people, you know, around campus and the coaching staff, and it just felt, there was just a feeling of like, this is kind of more where I belong. And the opportunity to play too. I mean, at that time, I think Stanford's roster was pretty top heavy with upperclassmen. They had some guys coming in. I think Mark Madsen was coming back from a mission. And I was like, it's pretty loaded with big guys here. So, even though the place is great, I know I can probably play right away at Notre Dame. And so that's what ultimately swung it for me.
So you show up at Notre Dame and Hoover's there. Lamar Justice, one of the all-time great nicknames, right? Blue? Because he's so black, he's blue. Like that's a great name. I don't know. Like I still think guys would have the nickname Blue. I just don't know if it would be as cool to have the nickname Blue as it was then, right?
Yeah.
Keith Kurowski, who I'll never forget. This is my favorite. I actually told this story to one of my children who was wiping her nose on her shirt. So Keith Kurowski was. He was a couple years older than you, right? He's a senior my freshman year. Christian Brothers Christian Brothers Academy, I'm going to say, in New Jersey.
Yep, that's New Jersey, right.
And he was like combo guard, nutty, but the kind of nutty white kid that you're like, all right, that kid can make it because you got to be a little off to be like a white scoring guard, right? You just have to. I don't know how to explain it otherwise. But like he would go in. I remember he would go in for like a layup in a game and go around his back and lay it in just because, right?
Oh yeah, no. My first memory of him was. So we get on campus, and like the first day, we drive from Colorado to Notre Dame, and my dad, like, we have all my stuff in the back. We go up to my room. It's this like tiny room, and the first thing he says is like, "I've lived in worse than this," you know. He's been deployed. He was in Saudi Arabia during the first Gulf War. So that's what he moves all my stuff in. He takes me over to the basketball office, and he says, "Okay, check in with those guys." He's like, "Get some gear." I got some gear, and then he's like, "Okay, I think you're set to go." He got in the car and then just drove back. Like, didn't even stay a day. And so Karaski was there, and so Karaski's like, "Here, I'll take you." And I think there was like, you know, kids are coming back. There's all this kind of stuff going on, and he's like, "Let's go play one on one." And so we played one on one for like 3 hours, and then he's like, "Okay, let's go to this picnic that's going on." And he's got like no shirt, like a gold necklace. He's driving like a Nissan 300Z, and like that was him.
My memory was he was a baller. Like, he would play one on one for hours, but he was kind of hygienically challenged, right? Like, the story I remember was, and maybe this was your freshman year, he broke his foot, and when you were in the dorms at Notre Dame, you built a loft, right? So you had more space on your floor. So he was up in his loft, and the bathroom's down the hall, and he had a broken foot. So he had to go down the stairs and walk down the hall to take a leak, and he was telling the guys, and like, "Dude, why don't you just take a Gatorade bottle, pee in the Gatorade bottle, throw it out in the morning instead of, and you have to go in the middle of the night, like, you got a broken foot, getting up, you know, running the risk of falling down, going down your ladder, and then walking down the hall." And he's like, "That's a great idea." So then they come to get him for a workout, because he had to attend all the workouts, and they look, and there's just bottles upon bottles of piss, right, along his window. That's
so gross.
But here's the story I remember. So McLeod, God rest his soul, John McLeod, he had this weird thing about, I don't know the weird thing, I mean, you know, there's things we always tucked in our chairs, right? But you always had to be wearing like your sweats to team meal or to mass or to a meeting. And I'll never forget, we were on the road, and I can't remember exactly where it was. It was a little bit later in the year. And like, I'll say it was Georgetown, and we go to have like meeting, film, and dinner, and you were his roommate, or he was your roommate, and you put on your Notre Dame blue Nike sweatsuit, zipped it up, came running down because you guys were running late, and you sit down, you're sitting next to me, and I look on your sleeves, and there's just snot, like dried snot, all up on your sleeves, and you realize that you had Keith's jacket on. Like, that's...
Yeah, no, he was definitely like a lot of things didn't bother the guy.
What's he doing?
Never healthy.
What's he doing now?
I think he's a high school basketball coach. I think he was outside of South Bend for a while, coach. And I lost track of him a little bit, but I would be shocked if he's just not coaching right now. I mean, basketball was the guy's whole life, and it was a shame just because he was never healthy. And if you were healthy, he had a chance to be a really good college player, I think, and just one of those guys that. Weird injuries one after the other, not related to each other, but never had the career that could have had.
Yeah, I mean, he was really, really talented guy, and I think the way basketball is going, it may actually kind of come around to him, right? Because he was kind of a positionless guy. He could score. He would take what then were questionable shots. Now guys take a higher volume of it, and he did in fact love the gym. How did you handle the losing?
Well, so, you know, it was right away as a freshman, you know, you're so worried about your own stuff. Like, am I doing well enough to play? Like, And so the way I would describe it is just trying to establish myself as a college basketball player that first year, you're a little bit selfish because how you're doing kind of takes precedent over the team. But it really wasn't until, you know, after, you know, I got established for starting right away as a freshman, then the sophomore year was just really, really painful because that was our first year in the Big East. That was your freshman year. Yeah. And we just didn't have the type. I mean, we were a mid-major D1 team with the guys that I think that we had. And we were just going up against the Big East at the time, which was one of the best conferences in the country and just loaded with talent. And so it was tough. I mean, it was hard to see what the path was to ever get better. And, you know, at the same time, there's just always the motivation to work on your own game and you got to take care of yourself and get better. But that was a tough time. That's for sure in the Big East.
Yeah. And then of course, I mean, I didn't help it when I got in trouble and had to leave, you know, doesn't help, help Jimmy Dillon get it right. I have a story for you. I don't know if you remember. I'm going to say, was it Matt Venkowski? Is that who it was? We had a walk-on.
Yeah. One of the walk-ons. Yeah.
Okay. Here's what I remember. This is brilliant guy, right? So Venkowski was a walk-on and I'm going to say he's like, I don't know. It felt like he was like 6'6". But you know, like I just remember he was just a big white guy, like hairy legs, you know, solidly built. Like I remember, and it's one of the cooler parts about Notre Dame, and then one of the weirder stories I can share. So we had this thing like where if you said I have to study, or if you said I got a tutor, or if you said I have a class, or if you said I have anything scholastically, they didn't never question you. They're like, just go. Like, go. You know? So Venkowski didn't come to practice, I'm going to say, for like 2 weeks. Maybe I'm inflating it, you know, as it's 20 years removed now. But he didn't come to practice for like 2 weeks. And we used to get together. And before now, they built the practice facility. We used to work out in the pit. It was a kind of auxiliary gym inside the then Joyce Athletic and Communicate, the Jack, where we played. And I remember, like, all of a sudden he's getting up shots, you know, and we're going to play. And then, like, he was in layup lines. And I was like, when'd you get here? He's like, he's like, do you think they missed me? And I honestly believe that no one knew he was gone. Like, the coaches didn't know. He even missed 2 weeks of practice. Like, you know, he's a walk-on or whatever, but to not have been, and I was just like, that was a wow. I cannot believe that a guy had missed that much practice and no one ever knew.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was definitely back then, and even at a place like Notre Dame, the school came first. You know, you weren't, the travel was arranged such that you weren't missing any class, kind of at the expense of, you know, rest and stuff like that. Yeah, a lot different than a lot of places.
Tell me about draft day.
Yeah, so that was the 1998 draft. It was in the draft was in Vancouver at that time, so I was up there with my family. My girlfriend at the time, I didn't really have a good idea of where I was going. I thought, I had really good workouts in Milwaukee, pretty good workout, in Atlanta. They were drafting Milwaukee was drafting 19th. I think Atlanta was 20th or something like that. So I had a pretty good idea that I was going in that range. So, end up getting picked at the 19th pick at the time. It was Milwaukee. So, you know, got up on stage, put the hat on. And what happens after that, you shake the commissioner's hand and then they take you back in the hallway to do just a bunch of different, you know, series of interviews. And so I remember I did my first one and I'm walking to the next and this guy is kind of standing over the notepad and he grabs me and introduces himself. He's a beat writer for the Suns. And he said, hey, have you heard about the trade? And I'm like, no, I haven't heard about it. He's like, yeah, I think that you're in a package going to Phoenix. I'm like, wow, that's, and at the time I hadn't worked out from Phoenix. I hadn't talked to any of their people. But that was the deal where Dirk Nowitzki was picked 9th. I was 19th. We were both traded to Dallas, as part of a three-team trade for Robert Traylor, who I think, I'm not sure where Traylor was picked, but he was kind of somewhere in between then. And then I was packaged with like three other guys to Phoenix for, and you know, I think multiple picks for Steve Nash, who at that time was a backup, but he was coming up on free agency. They had Kidd at the time. They weren't going to be able to pay him. And so ended up making that trade. So that's how I ended up in Phoenix. And so, you know, get on a plane the next morning and Danny Ainge wants to like work me out. You hadn't seen me before. And I saw last year, you know, Brian Colangelo and who was the GM at the time and Danny Ainge still jokes about this. He's like, that was one of the worst workouts that I've ever been a part of. This is you after draft night. He's like, I thought you were going to get us all fired. And so, you know, a little bit of a rough start there. It was the lockout year. So, you know, immediately after the draft, a week later, the 1998 lockout happened. And that was the one where we missed 32 games and didn't start playing until January. So it was really a weird season to be a rookie. But, you know, pretty good memories. Ended up kind of breaking into the rotation toward the end of the season, played in the playoffs, and got traded to Orlando after that.
Okay, so what was it like to be, like, again, this is, you didn't grow, as you pointed out, you didn't grow up thinking, knowing you're going to play in the NBA. Obviously, you had a great college career, your Big East Player of the Year, and then it became apparent you were going to play in the NBA. Do you remember that first, like, your first game, the first time you see your Phoenix Suns jersey with Garrity on the back? What is your first memory of playing in the NBA?
Yeah, so the first memory was, I mean, I can't really remember camp because I think camp was like 2 or 3 days long. And it was, you know, my first memory, honestly, I remember the preseason games, but I remember playing in the L.A. Coliseum against the Clippers the first game. And I had had a couple, we played two preseason games against Dallas, and I played pretty well. They played us a lot. I think I, you know, one game had 14 points or something like that. And I'm like, oh, okay, I can play. And then I just remember, like, when the games were for real, it was like, how am I ever going to score in this game? So didn't score at all in the Clippers game. But, you know, I just remember the size and the strength of these guys was just something unlike I had ever seen before. And, you know, it took a long time to get adjusted to what my game really was. Cause in college I was, you know, coming off screens and shooting and posting up, and that game, that wasn't going to work in the NBA. So I really had to figure out how I was going to play. And luckily the first two coaches I had, both Danny and Doc Rivers, I think identified where I could be, you know, most effective and useful, which was kind of as a stretch guy. And so that kind of changed my game, just trying to play to that and get as good at those skills as I could.
Yeah. What was Jason Kidd like? At that time, Jason Kidd was just becoming a guy who could make a shot, but I mean, peak of his athletic powers, 25 years old. What was Jay Kidd like?
Yeah. So Kidd was, he was one of the best leaders that I've seen who didn't talk. So he rarely said anything, but with him, there was never, so like, you know, now guys that can shoot around, it's kind of loose. There was never really a moment of looseness with him. Like when he got ready to play, wherever it was, practice or it was games, I mean, he was locked in and serious. And he was a guy that if you were open and it was the right pass or the right play, he just made the pass and the play. And he just was wired that way. And it was really like he was a special guy and so competitive, but just rare in his ability to lead like that and to bring the energy up of a team without being a guy that really talked at all.
What was Googs like? Tom Gugliotta.
So Googs was, you know, Googs would be like a four or five today. But you know, one of the things that I think that like his athleticism was a thing that I think people look at him and he's, you know, skilled, big, strong white guy. He had such a quick second jump. So that I think that's why he was always such a good rebounder, you know, and just a good nose for how to play. Like, in today's game, it's a little bit different. Like Googs was a mid-range guy, a little bit of a post-up guy, but he was more of a guy that caught mid-post and would turn and face and be able to to create a shot for himself, but just a really talented, skilled guy. But, you know guys like this too. One of those guys that's like not the highest energy guy in practice, you know, not the most like in terms of basketball IQ, I don't know how he would rate, but just in basketball instinct and scoring instinct and the nose for the ball, like he was terrific. And you know who was on that team really the other guy that, like in today's game, you look at him and you're like, this guy would have made, you know, $18 million a year. He's Cliff Robinson.
Yeah.
Like Cliff Robinson was like, he's that guy who's a 4-3. He could guard threes. He could guard small fours. He could shoot threes. He could guard in the post, and then he could guard on the perimeter. Like he was a guy.
Born too soon.
Yeah, no, he was too soon. And so most people, like, he would, I think back then, would almost get the, because he could guard in the perimeter, you could play him at small forward. But he was a guy back then who, he wasn't quite a tweener because he was big enough, but he wasn't like a prototypical power forward. Now he's the kind of guy that every team would want as a power forward.
So that year's, you mentioned it was a lockout shortened year. And lockout shortened years have kind of sneakily, I believe that was the first time. I want to say, like, didn't that ruin Sean Kemp? Like, some of these guys came back in terrible shape, and they kind of never recovered, right?
Yeah, no, it was, because we had a pretty good thing going on in Phoenix, because Jake Kidd organized workouts at this health club. Like, so we were working out, we were playing pickup every day. There were a lot of guys that were there. And then there were guys that lived in Phoenix at the time, like Barkley, and some of those other guys would show up and work out. So there were good pickup games, but there were other guys that were just off the map. Like, and you know, you remember that exhibition game that the Players Association had where they tried to create something to make some money and get some guys paid. And some guys showed up to there like 30, 40 pounds overweight. It was like a terrible game. And you were like, oh my gosh, what is this? What is this all about? But yeah, that was a tough stretch for a lot of guys, I think.
Yeah, I think the guys that I remember Mitch Richmond really struggling, Larry Johnson, Scottie Pippen, because that was Scottie Pippen with the Rockets, and then Sean Kemp and Vin Baker were the two who they never gained so much weight, and obviously Vin had the alcohol problem as well, but they like literally never. Sean Kemp supposedly weighed like 275, which means he really weighed 300. Like, he just never, Mitch Richmond, Sean Kemp, Vin Baker never recovered from the lockout.
Yeah, no, and that was a year too where you kind of hear about everything today of kind of managing players' workloads and trying to spread the schedule out and avoid, like, there were, I think we played like 13 back-to-backs here this year in Detroit, which was just like such a low number. That was a game during the lockout to get all those games in, but to get 50 games in between January and the 1st of May, they played three in a row, and there were a couple times where we played 6 and 7 nights. it was just like completely insane.
So you go to Orlando. What was it like to go to be traded? You know, now all of a sudden you were traded before you ever got to the NBA, but now you're traded in your career. What's that like to, you know, pick everything up, and now you're in Orlando?
Yeah, so that was the best thing that could have happened for my career there. So Orlando at the time, that was the original, I joke, like, that was the original tank job. Like, John Gabriel, like, that was the team at the end of the Shaq, Penny, Nick Anderson, Dennis Scott. So, you know, the prior 2 years, you know, Shaq had left in 96, I believe. And they were it was at the end of it. I think Penny was a little bit disgruntled. So they were trading everyone away. Nick got traded to Sacramento. I was in the trade with Danny Manning and, you know, again, like, you know, another first or multiple firsts for Penny Hardaway. And their plan that year was the original tank job. Like, they were going to get rookie guys, kind of cast off type guys, cheap contracts, get a ton of cap space for the 2000 season, and not really care about winning. Now, the problem with that was they had Doc Rivers as a first-year coach who you just saw it again this year. Like, his best attribute is just getting guys to believe in themselves and motivating them. And we ended up going 41-41 and missing the playoffs by one game. one of the guys, like the main reason of that was Ben Wallace. Like Ben Wallace, they got Ben Wallace in a trade from Washington, and Ben Wallace was just like, they threw Ben Wallace into a trade and ended up in Orlando. I don't think anyone in Orlando even, you know, knew that he was going to play there. And we just had a bunch of guys that played really hard together. Darrell Armstrong, Mike Miller was a rookie. We had Monty Williams, who played small forward. John Amici, who just had a terrific year as a starting center. Actually, he's a backup center. He backed up Ben Wallace. And so we just put these lineups together. Harpering was there. He was a little bit hurt. Doc just mixed and matched all these different lineups and ended up doing much, much better than anyone projected. And to this day, it's still my favorite season in the NBA just because of the guys and the coaching staff and everyone who was a part of that.
And the low expectations, right? Like low expectations, just playing, having fun. Hey, Ron Mercer was on that team. Yeah. And while he put up some numbers at various times in his career, I mean, here's a guy who was a top five high school American and All-American in Kentucky. And he never really became, was it as simple as he couldn't shoot? Like he was never a good enough shooter to be a two guard? He was in the NBA?
Well, at that time, he was a good, for that time, he was always a pretty good scorer. And Ron Mercer came midseason in a trade. So we started off the season with Tariq Abdul-Wahad and Chris Gatling. Those guys were traded to Denver. And that's how Ron and actually Chauncey was part of that trade too, all got there. Ron, if you look at Ron's career, I mean, Ron was a talented scorer, but never a 3-point shooter. He was a mid range guy. Like he was like the floppy guy. Like you bring him off screens, mid range jump, catch and shoot jump shots. That's what he was able to do. Ron was a guy that was just, you'd put him in the game, he'd do his thing, but he wasn't really an outgoing guy. But ended up having a pretty good career. I mean, I think, averaged over double figures for his career. And, he was out of the league. I'm looking out of the league, but I think before he was 30. Just a guy who was, a good scorer, but maybe just didn't do enough other things to hang his hat on.
So the next year you guys got Tracy McGrady and Grant Hill. Obviously, Grant was injured. What was Tracy McGrady like?
Yeah, so Tracy McGrady was just such a special player. And I think, people who remember the NBA during that time, obviously, like, he competed for multiple scoring championships. But and you ask anyone that played with him or coached him, Jeff Van Gundy says this all the time, too. Tracy McGrady was one of the best passers there was. And he was so effective because he could do it different ways. So you could put him in pick and roll. And he developed a good enough shot where you had to go over the top on him. If you tried to trap him, he was big enough where he could pick you apart on those kind of traps. And then the other thing, if you put a smaller guy on him, and I remember, teams used to do this, like Philly would do this. They put Eric Snow on him, just to, rough Eric Snow, tough guy, rough him up. He would take you down on the post and he would make plays out of the post. Like you'd have to double team him. And so he made my career there. Once he got there and you were in the game with him, it was just get your spacing right out of double teams and shoot threes, and he was going to get you the ball. So he was another one. I mean, he was for me, I think he was the best player that I had ever that I ever played with in the NBA. I mean, it was a shame that those teams just weren't strong enough where he got that label of, never making it out of the first round of the playoffs. And I don't think he did that until later in his career when he was with San Antonio. But,
But I mean, like, look, that would be my criticism would be like, how can you be viewed as this all time great? And I get it. Like any year you have bad luck and the series were shorter back then and they had some injuries and, Grant was never really right physically. But how can you never get out of the playoffs? We're not talking about championship. We're talking about first round.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of times, like, I was your starting power forward. So it wasn't like we had the strongest team in the world. It would have been, like, look, it would have been totally different if Grant Hill were healthy. Like, those two guys together, like, that it would have been different. Like, McGrady was carrying a team, and every year was like trying to patch it together around him with different bigs and different, you know, so he never, he was kind of just the lone guy on those teams.
Your point is well taken.
Like, I, you know, if he was that good, why not? But you look at what he did. It was hard to argue that he could have done more.
What was Grant Hill like?
So Grant Hill was a guy who had like a special feel for the game. You know, just a terrific teammate, a terrific guy to be around. He very kind of mature in his outlook, but just you just never with us never got to see what ultimately he was able to do. Like when he left and got healthy with Phoenix, is him at full strength and without the thought in the back of his mind of either, you know, I'm not fully right, or, you know, the times of what he was right, how long is this going to last? But we spent a lot of time together. There was a season where I was out for most of the season rehabbing my knee, and, you know, we spent a lot of time together talking about life and business and different things, and really just an outstanding guy.
He is an amazing guy. I've spent some time with him, and he also is a guy who hasn't always let a lot of people in, you know, or maybe in the media, he doesn't project a way in which he allows people in. Cause once you get to know the real Grant Hill, you're like, this guy's amazing. I really like him. You know, it's not far away from what the image is. You know, it's not like he's one person and then a different person with the real Grant Hill. I'm just saying, like, he is one of the guys that once you open up the hood, you're like, I really like Grant Hill. I like him. I almost wish he would show people like what a real dude he is. This is an important
story,
one because
great storyteller, great, and he loves eating too. Loves good restaurants. So he's a fun guy. But you're right, like very conscious of you know what he says around people that he's not close with, and protective of you know his privacy.
This is an important one because your life now with the Pistons is as an evaluator, right? Part of what you do. I mean, there's a lot of things you do, but how did Reese Gaines was a massive miss, right? Okay, so Reese Gaines is drafted out of Louisville in 2003. And, I mean, you know, here's a lottery pick, 6'6 point guard. And, I mean, you guys couldn't get rid of him soon enough. When did you know he didn't have it?
I would probably be making it up if I told you I had like a distinct memory of when he wasn't going to make it. So I just don't know. I mean, I just think that there was this is not about Reese, but just kind of in general, you can tell pretty early on just the level of confidence that a player has, and so aside from the top 50 or 100 players in the NBA, there's not a ton of separation really in talent, kind of with that you know, bottom 200 or 300, if you say. But what there is a separation of is like just kind of an innate belief in yourself and that you belong and that you can do it. And I think that wasn't there for him. And I think that a little bit probably had to do with, I think the idea was, you know, could he play point guard, and just didn't have the point guard skills. And, you know, if the idea is, there's no quicker way with anyone to like destroy their confidence than thinking you can make someone into a point guard and then putting them against NBA point guards and then that not working right away. So I think that had a lot to do with his situation. I think is that
Sean Respert had that too. Sean Respert. Yeah. I mean, Sean Respert was never a point guard, and you know, Eric Snow was his point guard at Michigan State, and I know there's some health stuff too, but. You know, it's interesting. You know, you ask a guy to do something he's never done before or never done at that level against, you know, you're asking guys to do something against a ridiculous level of competition, usually less minutes than they've ever had. All of a sudden they have to think and they're just kind of all locked up. When did you become super involved in the Players Association?
I became involved. My first couple of years in Orlando, I was a player rep. So every team has a player rep that, you know, you go to the meetings and kind of, you take the information back to your team. And I think by my third year in the league, there was a position on the executive committee that was opening up, and ran for that at one of the meetings and got elected. And then so that really started my involvement, because when you're a member of the executive committee, it's much more involved. I mean, you're doing a lot of conference calls and meetings and kind of getting ready for collective bargaining. So it was around that time, my second or third year, and stayed involved with it throughout my whole career. I mean, it was something that I enjoyed, kind of learning about how that aspect of the business worked, and met a lot of good people and like really great learning experiences about how the NBA actually worked as a business.
So is it fair to say, like, I always reference, who would know better about the cap than a guy who basically wrote this kind of new cap? Is that a fair assessment of your level of knowledge over how this particular salary cap works?
Well, I mean, I think that there's other people that have spent much, much more time kind of digging into the nuances than me. And so I wouldn't call myself kind of the top. I wouldn't call myself a lead in terms of knowing the cap. But the one thing that I think I do have is that just the context of why some of these rules are the way that they are. Because the way that the CBA is written, it's not like there's some like logical plan for why the rules are the way they are. A lot of it is just based on precedents that have evolved over 30 years, 40 years, starting with, you know, the biggest change was in, you know, 1998 when there was that lockout, and then another change in 2005 and 2010, and then recently. So I think that's, you know, knowing, being able to kind of recall rules and why the way things are, just because I had the context of why they were there in the first place, I think is something that's been really valuable, and it was really valuable about that time.
What's the one thing about the salary cap that most fans don't realize?
Well, I think that it's the one thing that I think is just really hard is kind of this time of year when it's free agency, is just figuring out what teams actually have to work with, because a lot of that information isn't public, and there are little ways to operate both as a team above and below the cap, and just different ways that you have to do business in those cases. So that's probably the hardest thing, is right now when you're seeing kind of all this movement happen and in knowing, okay, can a team still sign this guy or that guy, and they can't or they can, just knowing how a team is getting at, you know, the room below the cap that they're trying to operate with, I think is the hardest thing to understand for most fans.
You finish in 2008, and you decide to, and you're only 31 years old, right? And you're never really the same after the knee. You decide to go, was it right then you decided to go get your MBA, or what was the process like of deciding to get your MBA from Duke?
Yeah, so I thought about it. I had friends who I'd went to school with, had gone to business school, and to me it seemed like a good transition into whatever was next, and I didn't know it was next, so business school seemed like a good way to kind of organize that project of kind of moving on to the next thing. So I remember I retired in 2008. I, you know, physically, I knew I was done. It was hard for me to put in the work that I needed to put in just to be at a level where I could compete with guys and be a useful player. So I remember I retired and had been studying for the GMAT, you know, for the summer. So took that and then took a year off and applied to a couple different schools and ended up getting into Duke, which worked out really well because of its proximity to Orlando, where I was living at the time, and just went there not really with a plan of what I wanted to do, but just kind of use that time as a time to learn and develop some relationships and kind of see what else was out there.
So, okay, but go back though, your year off, what'd you do?
No, it was great. I worked out a ton. I played golf. traveled around, did a lot of stuff. You know, it was the first year of just not really doing anything, but I seemed to find time to fill my time. But I mean, living in Orlando, I lived in Bay Hill, so I was at a golf cart that I could just drive to the course and play whenever I want. So I was the best I ever was at golf during that year, I'll tell you that.
Okay, so you get done at Duke, and was it right then that, like, I've been told that before you took the Pistons job, you'd like offered up to Columbia, like, "Hey, I'll come be your third assistant. I just want to learn about coaching." Is that accurate?
Well, no, I was working after business school, so I didn't.
Oh, that's right. You went you went and you worked in the financial district, right?
Yeah. So I I interned for a year at a hedge fund called Bridgewater Associates, and then they offered me a full-time job after my internship. So right after business school in 2009, moved up to Connecticut with my family, worked there for 3 years. And it was at that time, I had a friend whose son was like junior in high school. He was going to play on an AAU team. My friend's like, hey, can you help this team out a little bit? So I started coaching with another guy, this team. And it was like a mid-level team, like, you know, some D2 guys, like, you know, maybe one D1 guy. But I really enjoyed it. And I'm like, man, I really do miss basketball. I mean, like the career was stimulating, it was interesting, it was hard, challenging, but it wasn't basketball. And so I think that time away from the game was good, but it allowed me to kind of, you know, shake the player off and try to be involved in the game a different way. And so I was like, God, I really enjoy this coaching stuff. And so I talked to different people about different things. You know, I'm so lucky the advice that I got, though. Like, after being back in the game now and, like, looking at the coaches' lives and then looking at the life of a front office person, it's not that, like, this job goes on year-round, but I would have been a terrible coach.
isn't that what Billions is based upon?
I think it's Billions is based upon 0.72, which is SAC, formerly SAC. But I think that there's elements of kind of every cliche hedge fund trait that are wrapped into that.
But I had a neighbor when I was in Connecticut that worked at Bridgewater, and he told me, isn't there some policy where like everything is shared, like every email, everyone knows about every email in the company or something like that? Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's a unique place. Every meeting is recorded. And you have access to the meeting recordings are shared. And yeah, the whole idea is like the way you get better just by being kind of radically transparent and honest with each other. And it's a really tough place when you have that kind of environment. But it's also a place where it's, you know, it kind of drives the best out of you.
So you get to the NBA and you get to the Pistons, and you guys have the Blake Griffin trade. How long before it was done did you know it was done?
Well, I mean, it was not up until kind of we agreed upon terms. I mean, I think the time that we started talking about it until it was done, I mean, it wasn't a crazy long amount of time. You know, it was.
Here's a better question. How does it start? Right? Did Stan walk in one day and go like, hey, I want Blake Griffin? How did that happen?
Well, no, I remember how it happened is Jeff Fowler, who was during the season, the setup at the time was, you know, Stan was head coach and president. Jeff Fowler was the GM. So on a day-to-day basketball ops type of basis, Jeff Fowler was kind of the one taking calls from everyone and making calls. And I just remember one day I think it was in January, kind of called everyone together and said, hey, is this something that we would consider doing. And everyone was like, whoa, like it was never something of like, okay, let's develop a plan to see if we could go get Blake. But this is how a lot of these type of situations happen is that, you know, there's a player that becomes available that can really, you know, change things for you that maybe otherwise wasn't. And you just really have to think like, how will this work? And so, you know, Jeff was the one that did the most of the negotiating there. And, it was a big departure from kind of what the team was at the time. And a lot of questions about if it would really work, but ended up making that deal. And I'll tell you what, last year, like he was unreal with what he was able to do.
So for people who don't watch Blake on a daily basis, as a former player, front office executive, what is something about Blake Griffin that people should know they don't know?
By far, it is his level of preparation that goes into getting ready to play every day. And, you know, I know people have written about the money that LeBron spends on getting ready, and I, you know, no doubt that he does that. But Blake, and I'm not familiar with kind of the whole routine that LeBron does, but it's clear like his whole life is about being ready to play. Blake, to me, is right up there with him in just how in tune he is with every aspect of performance, from his diet to his, you know, movement prep before he goes to practice, to his routine mentally before he gets ready for the game, to his lifestyle, you know, outside of the game during the season. The guy is the ultimate pro and warrior from what I've seen in the last year and a half that he's been around.
You've been mentioned for GM jobs, and you're a process of trying to, you know, complete the task of fixing this thing in Detroit, and there's all this kind of player movement. How do you balance out being happy, doing your job, and looking forward with the next thing, to have your own shop to run?
Yeah, so the way that you do that, in my opinion, is that you just do your job right now. Like, there's, and I believe this too. I mean, I think in the NBA is such a desirable business to be in and to work in if you're a basketball person. So there's tons and tons of people wanting to get in. There's tons and tons of people wanting to move up from the job they have to, you know, bigger jobs or higher profile jobs. And really, you can sniff people that are out for, you know, for themselves in a minute. And so I never wanted to be a person like that. So I really do believe it. There is no balance to me. It's, the only job right now is, you know, working together with Ed Stefanski and Arn Tellem and Malik Rose and those, and Coach Casey and those guys, to make this team good. And if you do that, then the opportunities present themselves. But, you know, to do it another way, it's just really hard for me, because it's just hard for me to imagine someone who would be all in when you're always kind of on the lookout for what's the next step of my career.
All right, the last thing, you got to go and I got to go in like a minute. Will we ever get back, like, the big guy, like Andre Drummond, obviously, because he can run and finish and defend the rim, but the game has become so perimeter-oriented. And you have to be able to switch and guard ball screens differently. Will it ever go back? Will we ever go back to where throwing it into the post is a big part of a half court offense?
No, you will not. The math just doesn't work. When you look at the offense that's created by having a primary score as a low post player, no. I mean, look, like, post ups, well, still you need them. I mean, it's a part of being able to penetrate, you know, the paint, get the ball inside and create. But the post up to me is now to create other shots.
Right. It's amazing, right? Yeah. Now it's, the post is to settle the defense so that you can create those jump shots. It's really remarkable how it's changed. Pat, I can't tell you how appreciative I am of your time, especially during this moratorium. Dude, I look forward to seeing what's next for the Pistons in the future. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Doug. It was a pleasure talking to you too.
All right, so we'll wait on Kawhi. I don't love what the 76ers are doing. I do love that Jimmy Butler's not there. And as much as I think the world of Josh Richardson and Al Horford, I don't know if it fits totally what they need. But boy, are they athletic. They can get after you. They can defend multiple positions. My question still is, can they make shots? And can Joel Embiid stay healthy? Can Ben Simmons make a jump shot? I think the Boston Celtics got worse in terms of talent. Kyrie's more talented than Kemba. Kemba's also older. But in terms of chemistry, I would think that Kemba has a chance to be better than Kyrie was. And kind of a three-headed monster inside instead of one starter and Al Horford, a fascinating way for Danny Ainge and Brad Stevens to attack the problem. Wouldn't stun me if the Celtics and the Bucks were facing off deeper in the playoffs next year. Most people know I've never been a D'Angelo Russell guy, but the thing that's weird is, are the Warriors going to go to a lot of ball screens? Because he's the number one or number two ball screen guy in the NBA. So look, I like what Utah's done. The idea of them winning a championship seems a bit far-fetched, but not crazy. We haven't talked at all about Denver. They're basically kind of running it back from last year, which was fun. Portland looks like they got more athletic at the rim, and they're very, you know, they're hoping, you know, there's no Golden State. Why not us? I know they got to the Western Conference Finals, but part of it was the road to get there. I'm not convinced that Oklahoma City stands pat, but even if they do stand pat, I think Russell Westbrook will shoot better, Paul George healthier. They may be a sneaky team that could make a run next year, because they still have two elite stars, which brings us to the Lakers, who we've all kind of handed some sort of mythical trophy to the Lakers if they don't get Kawhi Leonard. And though LeBron James is great and Anthony Davis is great, like, is their roster better than the Oklahoma City Thunder? No. Isn't it a guards game? Like, I don't know. I'm fascinated by this thing, but most fascinated by where Kawhi Leonard chooses to play next season. We got lots of college basketball stuff coming up. We got some great interviews over the summer. Make sure you tell a friend. You download, you subscribe, you rate. You'll hear all about some of your favorite athletes, some of your favorite broadcasters. Some of the best stories in all of basketball are right here. My thanks to you to listening to All Ball.